Iowa's seen major flooding in 1993, 1997, 2001, and 2008, with minor flooding in between. This hour, we'll talk about these frequent flood events and what we've learned from them. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For the most part, floodwaters are receding in Iowa right now. The heavy rains stopped in the nick of time. But every flood event brings up questions about our changing environment and the decisions we make about how and where to build. Today, we'll explore some of the lessons learned from Iowa's major flooding events, the role of climate change, and what communities and individuals can do to cope with frequent flooding. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's hard to make a comprehensive list of all of the major flooding events in Iowa over the last 25 years. We all remember 1993. That was huge. But many people along the Mississippi River remember 1997 and 2001 as being almost as bad. There was the huge flood in 2008, but don't forget about the floods in 2010, 2013, and now 2014 gets added to the list. At least 17 times since 1990, parts of Iowa have been declared federal disaster areas due to flooding. Damages have exceeded $20 billion. For the most part, this time, floodwaters are receding in Iowa. The heavy rain stopped in the nick of time, but every flood event brings up questions about our changing environment and the decisions we make about how and where to build. And that's what we'll be talking about this hour. With me in the studio today is Gabriella Villarini. He is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Iowa, and he does research in conjunction with the Iowa Flood Center that was founded in 2009. Hello, Gabriella.
Hi. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me here.
And Gene Tockley is also with us. He is director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University. Hello, Gene.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And the Flood Center has been working very hard to create accurate maps and models of how flooding occurs in Iowa and trying to glean as many lessons as we possibly can from what happens during these major flooding events. And Gabriella, I know that you've been focusing really on these major events themselves. And let's look at 1993 and 2008, because those were the biggest years. And tell me what was happening those years that resulted in these giant floods.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have been doing research related to trying to understand what are the drivers of this big flood events or flood events more in general over Iowa and over the central U.S. And what it turns out is that part of the explanation, or at least part of the drivers of these flood events, are what are usually or commonly related as atmospheric rivers.
Atmospheric rivers,
yeah,
okay.
Atmospheric rivers. So imagine a big river in the sky. And in 2008, imagine something like 100 times the discharge of the Mississippi River at St. Louis in the sky, transporting moisture over Iowa. That water got dumped over over our state, resulting in the 2008 flood. We did a number of studies where we tried to understand, tried to put this concept of atmospheric rivers more in a climatological perspective, trying to understand how relevant are these atmospheric rivers. Is it just the biggest floods? Is it more, do they occur more frequently? And so it turns out that more than half of the largest flood events over Iowa, but the central U.S. more generally, can be related to the occurrence of these atmospheric rivers. And so because of the importance of these events, we've been trying to understand whether they are indeed predictable. So can we forecast the occurrence of these events on a shorter time scale, could range from 6 hours to 2 weeks in the future? And what it turns out that using the state-of-the-art climate models, there is skill in forecasting the occurrence of this event up to about five to seven days in the future. After that,
you can't tell.
Absolutely.
Which is the problem that meteorologists and climatologists have run into since the beginning of time, that you can't actually see into the future. And, you know, Gene, In 1993, when we had this major flooding event, there were a lot of people talking about the 500-year flood. And of course, then just 4 years later, many of the same communities went underwater again. And we learned that just because it's called a 500-year flood or a 100-year flood doesn't mean that it can't happen 4 years apart. And of course, those terms don't get used very much anymore. But what can we learn about the frequency of these floods over the last 25 years?
Yeah, you've hit on a very important issue here, and just even in the last 5 years, since in fact four of the wettest May-June periods in Iowa have occurred since 2010. So 2010, 2011, 2013, and this current year, 2014. Are four of the eight wettest years in the 122-year history. So, and the other year, 2012, was very dry spring and a very dry summer. So again, it was an extreme. So it's we're saying now that extreme rainfall in Iowa has gone from a 1-in-20-year occurrence to a 1-in-4-year occurrence. So it really is a major change in the climatological shift.
And, you know, I think a lot of people, when we experience these tremendous droughts, in addition to these years of flooding, I think a lot of people said, now, wait a minute. You know, I thought we were getting wetter. We don't seem to be getting wetter. So how do we jive these droughts with these very wet May-June periods?
One of the pretty robust results of climate models is that if we look at general patterns over the globe, that wet regions are getting wetter and more humid, and dry regions are getting drier and hotter. And that also applies to individual events, that individual rain events are becoming more intense and more frequent. And so it used to be rather unusual that we would get a 4 or 5 inch rain, but now we get those. I think we had something like 5 or 6 5-inch rains reported somewhere in the state of Iowa just in the month of June alone. And so, but we're also seeing more years with low rainfall events. So the extremes are increasing, is the bottom line.
And as you look over history, Gabriella, you've talked about trying to look into the past to see if these atmospheric river events were occurring in the past. And you know, since we had the term the 500-year flood, I assume that they had occurred at times in the past. We don't have the same kind of knowledge about those events that we do about present events. But based on observations, what have you been able to see in the past?
Well, we are currently working on trying to understand how the frequency of atmospheric rivers has been changing over the historical record. But just by looking at the observational records, so discharge that we measure, USGS has been archiving, collecting, and disseminating data for 100-plus years at a number of locations over Iowa, as well as rain gauge data, so analysis of the historical records. All of the results that we have been analyzing points to the fact that, to a certain extent, it's not so much that the strongest or the largest flood peaks are getting larger. It's more that we are experiencing a larger frequency of big floods. And this kind of signature also manifests itself in the analysis of the rainfall records. So also rainfall data, as Jean mentioned, we are experiencing a larger frequency of heavy rainfall days over large areas of Iowa, but over the central United States more generally. So this is at least what the observational record has been pointing to.
Now, a lot of people look into the past and they see these events in the past and say, you know, there were always outlier events. Maybe we're just in an outlier period right now. Gene, how do we know If this is a new pattern, or if this is just a, sort of a freak occurrence over the last 20 years?
The best scientific models that we have to try to understand why this is happening show that with the increase in heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere, we just have the ability for the atmosphere to hold more moisture. And so, as Gabriella points out, there's more opportunities for these atmospheric rivers to be moving moisture across the state. And one of the changes that's been most important to Iowa is what we call the change in seasonality, which means that we're getting more rain in the spring and early summer and less in the fall. And and this has been projected by climate models for over 20 years, that this would happen for the state of Iowa. So it's not something that that's unexpected. It's really there's a pretty good physics basis for the fact that we're seeing these more extreme events coming in the spring and early summer.
Now, when we have these extreme events, of course, I mean, not only are we seeing our cities flood, but of course we're seeing our farm fields flood, and we're losing tremendous amounts of crops. I mean, I've driven past in my part of the state in southeastern Iowa. I've driven past bean fields that are washed out. I've driven past corn fields that have been washed out this year. With the changes, I mean, are we developing a pattern that we can rely on? I mean, we think about parts of the world where there are monsoon seasons, and it starts to feel like we have one of those.
That is correct. There were, in 2013, we had 730,000 acres in Iowa that were not planted because of the extreme precipitation in the spring. And we think about the days suitable for field work, and this is pretty critical in the April-May period with the planting period. And for every additional inch of rain that we get in this April-May period, it reduces the number of days that farmers can work in the field by 2.6 days. So when we start to see increases of 2 and 4 and 6 inches, that really reduces the amount of time farmers have to get the crop in the field. And as you point out, even observations, even they get it planted, then we're seeing a lot more ponding. We're seeing a lot more wider streams flowing through low-lying areas and leading to soil erosion. So there are multiple problems that we really need to face in coping with these extreme events.
We're going to take a short break here, and we're going to get back to this conversation. We're talking about the flooding events that have been taking place in Iowa over the past 25 years or so, major and minor flooding events with very, very wet May and June periods. But also, of course, we've had flooding events during other parts of the summer and even the fall as well over the years. I'm talking right now with Gabriella Villarini. He is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Iowa, and he does research in conjunction with the Iowa Flood Center. And Gene Tockley is director of the climate science program at Iowa State University. We're going to take a look at how communities have and should be responding to some of these changes in just a moment, and we'd love for you to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We may have mostly dodged the flooding bullet for now in Iowa, but we're taking some time this hour to reflect on the major flooding events of the last 25 years and what that means for our future, what we've learned from these events and what we can predict about the future, how we might want to change our behaviors and our building models as well. With me this hour is Gene Tockley. He is director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University. Gabriella Villarini is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Iowa, and he does research in conjunction with the Iowa Flood Center. And also joining the conversation now is Gary Taylor. He is Iowa State University Extension Specialist in Community and Regional Planning. Hello, Gary.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Now, we've been talking about these major events and how they seem to be getting much more frequent and how perhaps we can predict that they will be more frequent in the future. When we look at communities in Iowa, not that much has changed since these major flooding events started cropping up in 1993. There was an extensive investigative report done by the Des Moines Register last year that pointed out a lot of things, a lot of precautions that haven't been taken in the state of Iowa since these flood events started affecting the state. And when you look at communities and what they can do in Iowa, do you see us responding to these flood events in a constructive way?
I think there are certainly more things that we could do than we're doing right now. Traditionally, flood prevention measures, flood mitigation measures fall into one of three categories. Historically, we've relied a lot on dams, levees, flood walls, the big structural solutions. Federal money for these projects is becoming increasingly scarce. So communities need to look a lot more closely at the other two types of options, one being the most obvious, which is controlling what gets built in the flood-prone areas in the floodplain, and the other to be adopting practices that really keep rainwater where it falls as long as possible. If you can do that, you can moderate the rapid rise of creeks and rivers and slow down and try to reduce the likelihood of the flash flooding that causes so many of the problems in our communities.
Well, and when you talk about keeping rainwater in one place as long as possible, what are some of the things that do that? I mean, clearly cement doesn't do that.
No. So, yeah, cement is known as an impervious surface. Rain that falls on bare ground, on undeveloped ground, farm fields and such, only about 15% of that runs off and runs into the creeks. Whereas if you're talking about an urbanized area where you've got a lot of pavement, streets, rooftops, driveways, up to 75 to 85% of the rain that falls in those areas runs straight into the storm drains and straight into the creeks. And so what communities have tried to do in recent years is just find ways to slow that rate of runoff, adopting several unique and novel methods. Green infrastructure, if communities take a closer look at the natural systems that run through their communities and put trails and parks in flood-prone areas, put them in wetlands, ball fields in flood-prone areas. The kids might not play as much soccer in the spring as they would if the soccer field was someplace else. But these open areas do a tremendous job of absorbing runoff, cleaning the water of pollutants, and just slowing the rate of water running into the creeks and rivers.
You mentioned ball fields, and I have heard people say that the kind of lawns that we seem to love to have, the Kentucky bluegrass lawns, actually also repel a lot of water more than other kinds of vegetation. Is that part of the problem as well?
It's part of the problem. Kentucky,
although a lawn is better than a parking lot. Right?
Exactly. A lawn is better than a driveway. Kentucky bluegrass is not as much of a water-loving plant as some of the natural prairie grasses that grew in Iowa and still grow in Iowa, but were native to Iowa before settlement came. So they don't absorb water at the same rate as the little stem and other types of native grasses.
Now, you mentioned some communities adopting unique and novel methods. What are some of those methods beyond the green spaces?
Porous paving has become an interesting option. It still has cost challenges to it, but if you can think of pavement that doesn't repel water but actually soaks in rainwater as it falls at not the rate of bare ground, but certainly soaks in water more so than concrete. There are a number of different types of porous pavement surfaces that communities have used, have put in parking lots, in alleyways, in some of the more lower automobile traffic areas where pavement is needed. So porous pavement is one. bioswales as an alternative to paved storm drains. Bioswales are essentially ditches that we're used to seeing in the rural areas that are planted with water-loving plants. They slow the flow of the water to the stream. At the same time, these plants filter pollutants out as they travel through the bioswale itself.
So you may see a flooded ditch, but that's not a bad thing, and that is slowing the water down.
That's right. Water in the ditch, the longer the water stays in the ditch, the longer water stays in places like detention ponds and retention ponds. That is just slowing the flashiness of the creeks and rivers that cause so many of the problems.
Now, in a lot of our communities that are growing rapidly, we see this expansion into former agricultural land where the big box stores are getting built and the big parking lots are being put in, and that area just seems to expand and expand exponentially. Are there incentives? Are there rules that people have to follow to make those structures a little less impervious?
There can be. Cities across the country have done some pretty interesting regulations through zoning and subdivision codes that require porous pavement, that may require a certain percentage of a developable lot to be left as open space, to be left as pervious surface. You don't see as much regulation for novel approaches like rooftop gardens, or green roofs is what they're known as. But you see a lot more experimentation with these types of development approaches.
Do you know of communities in Iowa that have pursued that?
There are communities in Iowa that have done some of these things on an experimental basis with the more novel approaches like green roofs. You don't see regulations yet requiring green roofs, but you do see experiments in places. Dubuque has installed several porous pavement surfaces. Several cities do have regulations that require a certain percentage of a single-family detached lot remain in a pervious surface.
Now, we talk a lot about people who build in the floodplain and the risks involved in that, although there are still developments going in floodplains near some of these rivers that seem to flood quite frequently. When you're outside of the floodplain, how much of a difference does it make, the kind of construction that you do?
The regulatory framework for what gets built in the floodplain and what gets built outside the floodplain is really set by the National Flood Insurance Program. Communities that participate in the National Flood Insurance Program are required to adopt a floodplain management ordinance that primarily regulates what development looks like in the floodplain. And the primary method for lowering the risk to structures in the floodplain is elevation. The lowest floor of a building, of a residential building, has to be elevated above what's known as base flood elevation.
Okay, so that's something that would protect the structure that you're building, but that doesn't govern what that building or what that development may be contributing to future flooding.
That's right. I mean, one of the controversies about the National Flood Insurance Program, before you can build in the floodplain, there are certain engineering standards that you have to show with regard to it, your development's effect on other development and your development's effect on the floodplain, and whether you are forcing the floodplain out, whether you are displacing water that is then going to have to go someplace else. Some communities have gone a step further with some of their floodplain management regulations to require things like compensatory storage. So if you're going to fill the floodplain, if you're going to have to bring in dirt to raise your house above base flood elevation,
then you're making the floodplain bigger.
Yeah, and compensatory storage requires you to essentially dig a hole somewhere to absorb the water or to accept the water that you're displacing with your development.
Interesting. And now, of course, another thing about the flood insurance program that is controversial is a lot of people criticize the flood maps that the flood insurance program depends on as being old and out of date.
That's right. FEMA is making a concerted effort to update a lot of these flood maps. A lot of the flood maps were originally made back in the 70s based on not very good information. They're called approximate studies based on crude estimations of topography, of flood flows and things of that nature. We have a lot more technical tools available to us today to create more accurate floodplain maps. We have topographic maps that map an area at 2-foot contour intervals. In other words, the maps show differences in elevation of 2 feet, whereas old maps may have only shown differences in elevation of 10 feet, which is pretty significant when you're mapping a floodplain.
Right.
So there are tools available. The Iowa Flood Center, in fact, is working with communities in Iowa and FEMA to update floodplain maps.
And if you go to their website, you can see some really amazing interactive maps as well. If you are interested in this kind of thing,
that's right.
You definitely
exactly.
want to go check that out. We're talking about flooding this hour with major flooding events occurring so frequently in Iowa over the past 25 years. With me is Gary Taylor. He is Iowa State University Extension Specialist in Community and Regional Planning. Gene Talkley is Director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University. And Gabriella Villarini is Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa. You're welcome to join the conversation as well with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. And this is an email from Aaron, and I think this is a question for you, Gary. What is the role of the extensive system of drainage tiles in stream flooding? You were talking about how agricultural land absorbs water better, but we have spent a lot of money and a lot of effort trying to get water off of agricultural land in this state.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, there is controversy as to whether the field tiles actually accelerate or make streams flashier, or whether they in fact slow the flashiness of the streams because they hold some volumes of rainwater back for longer periods of time. We have people at ISU Extension, at Iowa State University in civil engineering and agricultural engineering that look at these types of questions. I am not one of those people, so I am not able to say definitively one way or the other. In fact, there are studies going on right now that are trying to assess the overall impact of tiled agricultural fields on flood risk.
Well, and I know, you know, with trying to make the most out of agricultural land over the years, there have also been many streams that have been straightened. The curviness of a stream definitely slows down the water and also offers more opportunities for plants to absorb that moisture. I know that there are organizations working to restore streams and rivers in Iowa, although we have seen a trend in recent years with a lot of land being taken out of CRP and being put back into row crops. And that seems like something. And we've also seen a lot of trees and other things along the edges of agricultural fields getting cut down to put in a few more rows of very, very profitable corn. I mean, those seem like trends that also could contribute to more flooding. Gary?
I think that's right. I think anytime you create bare soil, anytime you break up the cover, the grass cover, or you don't leave corn stover on the field, you're creating an opportunity for more rapid runoff than you would have with those things in place.
Well, we are going to take another short break. And Gary, I know you have to leave soon, but we'll hang on to you for just a couple of more minutes. Gary Taylor is Iowa State University Extension Specialist in Community and Regional Planning. Gene Tockley is Director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University. And Gabriella Filarini is an Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa, who does research in conjunction with the Iowa Flood Center. And you are welcome to join our conversation as well. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Are there things about your home, your property, your life that you've changed because of Iowa's frequent floods? We'd love to hear your story. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about flooding in Iowa, something that's been happening a lot over the last 25 years. With me is Gene Tockley. He is director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University. Gabriella Villarini, assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Iowa. And Gary Taylor, Iowa State University Extension Specialist in Community and Regional Planning. And Gary, since I know I have to let you go in just a moment, I want to get a couple of more questions into you before you leave. And one of them is, are there things that individuals can do that make an impact? If I plant a rain garden in my yard, does it make a difference?
Every little bit helps. Rain gardens are a good way of slowing the flow of water off of your property into the storm sewers. They're essentially depressions that you make in your yard. You plant them with water-loving plants. The rain garden really becomes an end receptacle for rooftop water. It's sort of like a mini detention pond.
Okay. And so that's something that might, on a very small level, it might help my basement not flood? Is that, I mean, if you want to look at it on a very personal level?
It could. I think you have to look at it cumulative impact of multiple homeowners doing the same thing.
Okay.
You will see that over time, if you have more landowners doing things like rain gardens, rain barrels, porous pavement, the cumulative effect of that will reduce the rapidity of the runoff to the streams.
All right. And it's something for the greater good. I think we all want to know what's in it for us.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's right.
It's something to contribute to the rest of the community. And, of course, it may prevent your house from flooding somewhere in the future as well. Bob is on the line in Marshalltown with a question. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I was wondering, they're talking about the pipeline from Canada to the coast or maybe something like a waterway along an interstate, like 35, if we could channel our floodwater to that and then deposit it in Kansas or Oklahoma or whatever, so they could use it for irrigation down there in these kind of times.
All right. Thinking outside the box, Bob. Who wants to tackle that? Gary?
Could work. there's been discussion for decades about diverting Great Lakes water to more arid climates for irrigation purposes. I see no reason why this idea could not could not be added to the mix.
Oh, all right. Well, Gary, I know you have to leave. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Gary Taylor is Iowa State University Extension Specialist in Community and Regional Planning. With me still, Gene Tockley, Director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University, and Gabriella Villarini of the University of Iowa. And again, you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Paul is on the line in Story City. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, first I want to say hello to Gene, because I went to Luther College when he did.
Okay.
He was a great distance runner up there. Anyway, and you, Charity, I'm sure Don Forsling saw your talent, and he was right.
Oh, okay. Thanks a lot, Paul. What would you like to talk about today?
Well, one of my concerns is that when you talk about these flood control issues and all that sort of thing, eventually you get into politics and global warming and all these problems people have, it's been politicized so much that I just wonder what your guests think about what barriers might exist in terms of people, you know, opposing some of these methods of flood control based on politics.
All right, Paul, thank you very much for bringing that up. And Gene, do you want to take that one on?
Yes, of course. Thank you, Paul, for your message. Politics certainly get in the way of what we would consider the most logical solutions to some of these issues. For instance, as was mentioned about rerouting Great Lakes water or major diversions outside a basin in which the natural basin of where water falls. Is a huge issue, and certainly it's very contentious. But we're facing a changing climate, and we know that we're going to have to look at a variety of different solutions. And first of all, we need to get these issues in the public debate so that we can make more informed decisions and decisions that are based on good science. And also to keep away from special interests having a disproportionate influence on
Gene, in your career, oh, did we just lose Gene? I think we did just lose Gene. We will try to reconnect with him. And Gene, are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Good. That's excellent news.
Sorry. I must have cut out.
Oh, no. So in your career, in focusing on these issues, have you been surprised by how politicized this conversation has become?
Yes, it's become very politicized. 20 years ago, when I was giving talks on climate change, it was really there was not really much interest. But now when the choices that we make have very significant economic consequences, now it's become a lot more politicized, and it's making a much larger impact.
Gabriella, have you also been surprised by how politics play a role in the research that you're doing?
I can tell you I have 20 years experience, given that I started as a faculty a couple of years ago, but everything that either you read in the news, you read in the blogs, you follow the discussion at conferences, it strikes me how a big part of the conversation is more political than scientific. We almost lose track of the science in favor of the politics. I think as Jean mentioned, that we should stick to the good science and trying to examine a range of possible solutions and possible decisions.
Now, with Gary off the line, we have a few questions that may be outside of your expertise, but I'll bring this one up. This is an email from Nick in Chicago, who is curious. He says, would it be worthwhile, for example, for the town of Maquoketa to work with towns upstream to make changes to combat flooding, not just locally, but along the entire waterway? And we've talked about changes mm-hmm. that are made in individual communities, but of course, we're all part of whatever watershed we happen to live in. So, Gabriella?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is part of the, to a certain extent, part of the effort that the Iowa Flood Center is putting forth, is trying to organize all these communities so that downstream communities might benefit from activities performed upstream. And so these watershed management's plans and organizations are geared towards an overall view of the watershed, not just the individual, communities, so that then these individual communities might actually benefit from activities that are performed over a wider scale or at the entire watershed scale.
Gene, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think this whole issue has really helped inform people that when they share watersheds, they share some important factors with regard to flooding, and so it does make sense to work together for watersheds to create this kind of organization.
Of course, then we have towns where it's very difficult to make changes within one community, let alone trying to collaborate with other communities to make these large changes. That's a major challenge on the horizon. Christine is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Christine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what would you like to talk about?
You asked what people have noticed in their neighborhoods in Iowa. Picking up on the thing that was just said, sharing watersheds, I mean, affects neighborhoods, obviously. And when I moved from Minneapolis, so we moved from Minneapolis in 2006, the first thing I noticed that the size of the storm drains here is huge. It's it can take trash in it. That was very different from Minneapolis. And so these flash floods are no accident. There's also an incredible level of lawns here. I don't know why there's not more gardening. I noticed that difference very much compared to the north. And then what Minneapolis has that is not so difficult to do is they do a stormwater utility fee and credit you for lack of runoff if you have like impervious pavement, pavement, for example, or a rain garden. So you get money back, and those that have lots of impervious surfaces have to pay more. So they even subsidized rain gardens with a little bit of money and had classes how to calculate the size of your rain garden. All that is lacking. It's not very expensive to do these things compared to what it costs to mitigate a flood. In our neighborhood, we have a regular flash flood, and there was a creek that had been overbuilt. It's just accepted by everyone here. That doesn't seem to be the awareness how important water is here.
So you've been very surprised in this community that floods quite frequently.
Yeah, and the history of Iowa with these incredibly deep-rooted, the tall grass prairie here is also somehow forgotten because that's not there anymore. To me, it's a no-brainer that, unlike what the expert said earlier, the impact of tiles must be having impact on flooding. They cannot replace these deep, deep roots that held the water back.
Christine, thank you so much for calling. Christine in Iowa City. And now I don't know, Gabriella, if this is something you would know. Are there, I mean, so many of our communities in the United States are built on rivers. That's just part of how this country grew. Are there model communities that we can look to that have created flood mitigation systems that are considered to be really state-of-the-art and innovative?
I can't think of an example from the top of my head, but there are indeed some communities. Probably the example that I can think of is more on the coastal regions subject to flooding, subject to hurricanes. And so they have to wrestle with this issue, whether it's the wind, the storm surge, or the river in flooding. And so they had to take to put measures in place to alleviate the issue. And those are the only case, the only situations that I can really think of.
Now, we have just a few minutes left, and I want to spend some time looking into the future. And Gene, I know that when you educate people about climate science, there's always the importance of drawing a distinction between meteorology and the weather and climate, but both are somewhat difficult to predict. I mean, first, we're not talking about forecasting the weather when we're talking about thinking about these long-term trends in our climate, right?
That's correct. There's often a misconception between weather forecasts, which are forecasts out to a week or maybe 7 days or so, from a climate forecast, which is a forecast or a simulation that creates a scenario into the future that may go 50 or 100 years. They use the same types of models, but in the climate forecast, we're not making a forecast of individual days, but what the averages would be during a certain window of time in the future. So, for instance, a mid-century climate simulation would give us a plausible condition for July 8th in 2050. It wouldn't give us an exact condition, but rather what the averages would look like. And that's a very different type of forecast, even though we use the same laws of physics.
So as we look into the future, knowing what we know today, what can we predict in the next decade for flooding in Iowa?
Probability that we will see an extension of the trends we've already been seeing is quite high. That is, it's very likely that the extreme events are going to be with us, but it could be in both directions. That is, as I pointed out earlier, it could be more extreme flood events. There could be more extreme drought events. The cone of uncertainty that we're used to seeing for hurricane landfalls also applies to our future in terms of rainfall conditions across the state. And so that cone is just wider now, and there's going to be a higher likelihood that we will be something other than average.
And, Gabriella, I know you're also trying to gaze into your crystal ball and using modeling to try to see if we can predict these atmospheric rivers like we saw in 1993 and in 2008. Have you made progress on that?
We're actually, as part of the Flood Center effort, we're trying to work on a number of temporal scales. So whether it's the very short term, more like on towards the weather forecast, so the 1 to 5 day range, but also trying to get a glimpse of what's going to happen over the next month to season to year, and also then started working more towards decadal prediction. So the point we are now is we are evaluating what is the first step is all this information that is available, is it of any use? Is there any skill? And so the first step is understanding how skillful these models are for months to season to year forecast, and then try to provide that information more generally to the public, and then move also towards a decadal prediction, what's going to happen over the next 10 years.
Well, and we'd love to know that. So keep us posted on your progress.
Will do. Thank you.
Gabriella Villarini is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Iowa. Gene Tockley, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Gene Tockley is director of the Climate Science Program at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa, and River to River is coming up at noon today. Ben Kiefer, host of the show, is here with me. What's coming up on the show today, Ben?
Hi, Charity. When I look back 25 years ago, this month was when the crippled DC-10, fully loaded with nearly 300 passengers, crash-landed in Sioux City at the airports. And we're going to be talking with the new author of a book about that tragedy. Miraculously, 184 survived, but also two surviving flight attendants at noon.
I remember that well. We'll be listening. River to River coming up today at 12. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.